Well, welcome to our Alpha Phonics workshop. What we're really discussing here is how to teach a child to read our alphabetic writing system. And I'd like to ask you here, how many of you had phonics when you were being taught to read yourselves? So good many of you do know what phonics is about. And teaching a child to read an alphabetic writing system is not difficult at all. There are really three stages or three things that you have to do. The first thing, of course, is teaching the child the letters of the alphabet. And what I do is I use the very simple alphabet poem, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, Z. Now, if you notice, W has three syllables, W, X, Y, Z. You'll find that in the alphabet song, they contract the W into two syllables and then add the and Z. You know, they'll say W, X, Y, and Z. And so children think that there's a letter called and Z. There isn't any. So take your time and give the W its due. It has three. It's a three-syllable word, W. And you don't need the and to confuse the child. Once the child knows the letters of the alphabet, then you have to teach the sounds that the letters stand for. You see, what is an alphabet? Yes. What is an alphabet? An alphabet is a set of letters that stand for the irreducible speech sounds of the language. So those letters have meaning. They stand for something. They're not there just for decoration. In fact, the alphabet was invented specifically to get away from what you would call sight reading, that is, the ideographs. Our ancestors first used pictographs. In other words, the cavemen drew pictures on the walls of their caves, pictures which more or less depicted what was going on. You could understand them. You didn't have to go to school to understand them. And then, of course, as civilization became more complex, the scribes had to begin drawing pictures of things that did not lend themselves to depiction. I mean, it's easy enough to draw a picture of an animal or a tree or a bow and arrow, but how do you draw pictures of ideas? How do you draw pictures of good and evil, right or wrong? How do you draw a picture of ever or forever? Can you imagine drawing a picture of forever? How do you draw a picture of... You can't. So what do? You draw a little picture, and you tell everybody, this little picture stands for forever. It doesn't look like forever, but it's forever. And the scribes created thousands and thousands of such pictures, none of which look like anything they represent. And, of course, they were very difficult to master. It took years to memorize all of these ideographs. They were easily forgotten. And so literacy was more or less restricted to a small number of scholars and priests and scribes who spent their lives learning these ideographs. Now, Chinese is an ideographic writing system. Each Chinese word is represented by one of those little squigglies, none of which look like anything they represent. As you know, chicken chow mein, the symbol for chicken chow mein doesn't look like chicken chow mein. Well, somewhere, sometime around the 2,000 years before Christ, the birth of Christ, somebody made a remarkable discovery. Somebody discovered that all of human language, everything we say, is composed of a small number of irreducible speech sounds. And that individual said to himself, instead of using this cumbersome system of ideographs, which take years to master and are easily forgotten, why don't I create a small number of symbols to stand for the irreducible speech sounds of the language, and then we will have a simple and direct means of transcribing the spoken word directly into written form, and an equally simple means of translating the written language back into its spoken form. And so the first alphabet was invented. Now, as I said, all of human language is composed of a small number of irreducible speech sounds. Now, how many speech sounds do you believe that there are, or do you know that there are in the English language? Does anybody want to volunteer? How many irreducible speech sounds are there in English? Does anybody know? Don't tell me you haven't, no one's read my book. Well, there are 44 sounds in the English language, believe it or not. Now, you might ask, how come we have a 26-letter alphabet? Why don't we have 44 letters in our alphabet? That's a very good question. Well, what happened was this. When the Romans conquered the British Islands, they imposed the Latin alphabet on the people who lived there. And so the people who lived there adapted the Latin alphabet to their needs. Now, if you're going to use 26 letters to stand for 44 sounds, you're going to have to make some rather interesting accommodations. Some of your letters are going to have to stand for more than one sound, and some of your sounds are going to have to be represented by more than one letter. Take, for example, the letter A. It stands for at least four different sounds. It stands for the A as in apron, the long A, or April. It stands for the short A, the A as in cat. It stands for the R sound as in father or car, and it stands for the OR sound as in all or ball. So how does a child learn which sound to articulate when he sees the letter A? Well, if you teach the letter sounds in their spelling families, children learn them very nicely. They don't have any problems. Then, as I said, we also use two letters to stand for a single sound. For example, our typically English sound is represented by TH. The SH is represented by SH. It's not SH. It's SH together standing for SH. And the CH stands for CH. In other alphabets, you may have one letter to stand for those sounds. In the Russian alphabet, for example, they have one letter to stand for SH, one letter for CH, and then they have one letter to stand for a combination, SH-CH. There's actually a letter in Russian that stands for SH-CH. That's because it's a very guttural language, and they need that sort of thing. But one of the beauties of our English writing system is that we have about 20 vowel sounds in English. We have a very rich vowel system in English. And that's why it lends itself to drama so beautifully and to poetry, because of our rich vowel system. But we've only got five vowel letters. And if you add Y, that's six. So think of the work that our vowels have to do. All right. Another very important thing about the invention of the alphabet is this. Nobody knows exactly who invented it or when it was invented, but here's something very interesting. Moses, as you know, was brought up by an Egyptian princess. You recall that Moses was brought up by an Egyptian princess? So he had the best education that Egypt could provide. He knew all the hieroglyphics. He was very, very well versed in reading hieroglyphics. But then he went up to Mount Sinai, and what did he get up there? He got the Ten Commandments. And how were the Ten Commandments written? Were they written in hieroglyphics? No, they were written in alphabetic writing. Isn't that curious? Yes. Alphabetic letters. Now, did he get it from God? Did God hand down the alphabet? Well, of course, the Hebrews believed that the alphabet was of divine inspiration. Why? Because, you see, man had to wait until he had an alphabet before the Word of God could be put precisely and accurately in print. Because how does God communicate with the human race? Does he send us little pictures? Does he send us ideographs? Does he send us comic books? No, he speaks to us through the Word through his prophets. The Word. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. So the Word becomes your most important element in all of this. And the only way that you can transcribe the Word into written form is through an alphabetic writing system. Now, isn't it curious that our public schools are making it more and more difficult for the youngsters to master their alphabetic system? Why? Because they want to make sure that they can destroy the link between not only God and the Word, but man and the Word. You see, if man is looking at the Word as a little picture, he's not able to read the Word of God. So there's more behind this whole movement away from alphabetic reading in our schools. As a matter of fact, this new form of whole language, they're teaching the children to read subjectively. In other words, they're saying you can guess at the word. As a matter of fact, in some classrooms now they have a sign that says, if you don't know the word, skip it. They encourage guessing, they encourage word substitutions. In other words, they're getting away from the accuracy and precision of alphabetic writing, which is absolutely essential if you're to read the Bible. So remember, the scripture is alphabetic writing, and Moses was given the scripture in alphabetic writing. That's a great mystery. How could someone who was educated in hieroglyphics go up there and come down with an alphabet? One of the great mysteries. You won't learn this in a public school, of course. Well, now, so how do you teach our alphabetic system? As I said, we have a few problems because we're using 26 letters to stand for 44 sounds. So I worked out a method. I thought this over. I gave a good deal of thinking to this, and I decided that the best way to do it was to first introduce the child to the short A sound, as I do here in Lesson 1. Incidentally, all of the instructions are in the back. And if you need more than written instructions, I've also put the instructions on audio tape. So if you have not had phonics yourself and need that additional assurance, then you can get the audio tapes as well as the book. But we start with the short A, and you simply tell your child after they've learned the alphabet, you say, now we're going to learn the sounds that the letters stand for. And you explain exactly what the alphabet is to your child. Don't underestimate the intelligence of your child. First of all, children teach themselves to speak their own language all by themselves. At that stage in life, their brains are growing at a rate that will never be duplicated. I'd say from the year, say, 2 to maybe, what is it, 8 or 10, when they become like us, you know. They become slow learners. But at that particular moment in their lives, their brains are expanding. They are learning so quickly that they feel enormously intelligent. Because let's face it, if we had brains like that, we'd feel enormously intelligent, wouldn't we? If we could learn French and Russian the way they're learning English, wow. You know, and they're doing it all by themselves without the help of Sesame Street. So they feel enormously intelligent. They've developed a speaking vocabulary in the thousands of words. And so by the time they're ready to learn to read, they have mastered the spoken language to an extent that you can depend on their intelligence. You could speak to them practically in adult terms. As a matter of fact, I don't think you should talk down to children. I think you should speak to them at your level, which may be speaking down to them. But never, do not underestimate the intelligence of these youngsters, because their ability to understand abstraction is greater than you think, because remember, they have mastered a symbolic system. After all, they're mastering sound symbols, sounds that stand for objects, you know. So they know that there's such a thing as symbolism, and you can always explain it to them. I remember I was talking to a friend of mine who had taught his child to read with one of my books, and he had actually read to his child that whole introduction in How to Tutor, in which I discussed the origins of the alphabet. And so once at dinner, they just happened to be talking, and he asked his child what was the most precious thing to him, and his child thought, and he said, letters. Letters were the most precious thing to him. Well, you know, the concept was conveyed. That youngster realized that our alphabet is probably the most precious invention of all in human history, and he was able to articulate that. Well, anyway, we start with the short A, and then we teach 5 consonant letter sounds, the M, which stands for M, the N, which stands for N, the S, which stands for S. And of course, there's a soft S and a hard S, but we just say S. T stands for T. That's the irreducible sound, T, you see. And then the X stands for X, which is actually a combination of K and S. And you tell the child that if you put A and M together, you get AM. If you put A and N together, you get AN. If you put A and S together, you get AS. If you put A and T together, you get at. You get at and x together, you get x. And then you can demonstrate to the child that these are words that he uses every day, particularly am, you know, I am going to the store, and he is eating an apple, as he is as tall as she is, at we are at the store, axe. Well, if the child doesn't know what an axe is, you can draw a picture of an axe or show him an axe if you've got one in the garage or in the barn. And then what we do in the next lesson, we simply take those same letters and we take the S and put it in front of the am, and they get Sam. You put the M in front of an and you get man. The H, then you teach the letter H. The sound of H is, what is the sound of H? Right. In front of as gives you has. S in front of at gives you sat. T in front of axe gives you tax. And of course, you can explain all of these words. You might define the word tax. Let the child know what a tax is, because he'll be paying it for the rest of his life. So. Well, by lesson three, they can. We're beginning to teach spelling families. Am, Sam, am, man, as, has, at, hat, axe, tax. And then we can make our first sentences. Sam, sat. You explain the capitalization of a name and also the beginning of the sentence, a period. Sam has an axe. And so the child by now is quite excited at the fact that he knows these letters. And from these few letters that he has learned and their sounds, he can already read these words and two sentences. Well, then we go on from there and we teach the rest of the consonants with the short A. Now, for example, by lesson five, we've added D, so we've got add, had, dad, sad, tad, mad, am, ham, dam, sam, and man, dan, tan, as, has, and then we put W-A-S in a little box. Why? Because W-A-S is not pronounced was, it's pronounced was. Now, children do not have problems with those irregular pronunciations for one very simple reason, that if they pronounce them the way they were spelled, they would not mean anything. Child knows he's not going to say, I was going, you know. He'll know that it was, and children do not expect 100% consistency in life because you're not consistent. So why should the alphabetic system be consistent, you know? Life is not, you know, consistent. So they expect that, and they learn those words very well. I have no problem with the, but we put in a little box just so that you can tell them that it has an irregular pronunciation. Now, some of our words that have that kind of irregular pronunciation are that way because at one time they might have been pronounced differently. As you know, over the centuries, pronunciations change, but the spellings, once we got our dictionaries in the 17th and 18th centuries, the spellings became standardized. Previously, before the dictionaries were printed, people wrote the words in many different ways. I mean, they spelled them any way they wanted, just so to make sure that you knew what they were talking about. But once those spellings were standardized, speech and pronunciation may have changed, but the spellings remain the same. And that's all to the good, because if we spelled English the way we pronounced it, then you would not be able to read a London newspaper or a Sydney newspaper or a Johannesburg paper or a Nairobi paper because, as you know, there are different accents all over the world. I was in Australia for 5 weeks, and I can tell you the way they speak English, you'd have a different alphabetic system, you know, with some of your vowels particularly. But because we have this standardized writing, you can read a newspaper from Toronto or Savannah, Georgia, New York City, or Melbourne, Australia, or Cape Town, and it's all the same English. So that's the beauty of our standardized writing system. Now, we teach the rest of the consonants with the short A, and then we give the child plenty of drill. Incidentally, on lesson 12, some of these lessons are very short. For example, in lesson 12, we just teach the word A, or a cat, a hat, etc. In lesson 14, we give the youngster plenty of drill, every conceivable combination of the consonants with the short A. You know, bab, back, back, bad, baff, Now, you might say, well, why teach bath? That's a nonsense syllable. Yes, but it'll wind up in a word like baffle, you see. So none of these syllables are useless because you'll find them later on in multisyllabic words. Well, a word like bap. Well, later on they'll read Baptist, you see. So these are what you want to do is to make sure that that child develops that automatic association between letters and sounds, because that is the key in becoming a phonetic reader, to have that association, automatic association between letters and sounds. You see the letters and you hear the sounds. As you know, when you read, you have that sub-vocalized voice in your heads reading along with you. Why? Because you're reading spoken words, you see. Now, the sight reader usually has memorized a good deal of words, but when he comes to a word he doesn't know, it's silent. He looks at it and he says, now, what in blazes does that say? He has to figure it out, you see. But a phonetic reader doesn't have to figure it out. A phonetic reader starts sounding it out immediately and works at it. If it's a, you know, for example, these days with so many new words being invented, like these multisyllabic pharmaceutical terms. You ever looked at some of these bottles? The other day I got an encyclopedia of prescription medications. Wanted to give it to a hypochondriac friend of mine as a gift. But I mean, you know, they're inventing these new words all the time. I mean, they're multisyllabic, and how do you figure them out? Well, you divide them up into syllables, but even an experienced reader has to stop and sound them out and say them over a couple of times. But anyway, so we that's how we proceed. Then in lesson 15, we take up the rest of the short vowel sounds. And because they know the consonants, it's very easy now to deal with the vowels. So we teach them in contrasting spelling families. Bad, bed, bid, bod, bud. Bag, beg, big, bog, bug. Now, some kids have a problem with the eh and the ih. A pen is a pin or a pin is a pen. But if they see the difference as well as hear the difference, then it's easier to get them to say it. And you can tell them that there's a difference between a pen and a pin. You see, it takes a little doing, but it can be done. So if you have a youngster who has some pronunciation problems, the phonics will help. The phonics will help produce better enunciation and clearer enunciation. So then we move on through all of the short vowels. And incidentally, we intersperse each lesson with sentences so that the child makes immediate use of the new sounds that he's learned, of the new letters and the new sounds, makes immediate use and is able to read these sentences. And incidentally, we've had very, very good results. I'm just amazed at the people who come up to me and tell me how well it's worked with their youngsters. And I'll tell you the reason why it works well. It's logical. Very logical, and goes from one step to another in very small increments, and the difficulty gets more as you go on, so that the youngster is able to handle everything. And the kids are very logical themselves, because remember, when they were teaching themselves to speak their own language, remember, not only did they have to, you know, listen very closely, but they developed syntax, they developed grammar, you know. I mean, they know how to put sentences together, and they do it automatically. So there's a logic up there. What the public schools try to do is destroy that logic. They destroy that natural logic, and they impose something very illogical on the children. And that's why these kids become learning disabled. Can you imagine youngsters who enter school having taught themselves to speak their own language, are exposed to public school for 6 months, and are then labeled learning disabled? They're not learning disabled. It's the teachers who are teaching disabled, you see. So their teaching disability then affects the youngsters, and so perfectly healthy, normal kids then become so-called learning disabled. All right, in lesson 21, we introduce the TH sound. Now, prior to this, there isn't a single sentence with the word the in it. Why? Well, we found that we didn't have to use the. And when we teach the TH, not only do we teach the word the, but we can teach that, than, the, them, then, thin, and this. Now, there are two sounds to the TH. There's the hard TH, which is thin, think, and then there is the and than. And you wouldn't say think, you know, it's think. And kids know it. The spoken language is your authority for pronunciation, you see. So our alphabetic system you might say, a 90 to a 95% representation of the spoken word. But otherwise, you've got to know the spoken language. Because have you ever heard some of these foreigners who have been taught English simply on the basis of reading it, and they make these unusual errors in pronunciation because they've been taught that that's the way these letters are pronounced, but because they don't know the language itself, they make some rather interesting errors in speech. I've had that. I should write them down and keep a track of them, because they are rather interesting, but it shows how they rely totally on the rules that they've been taught in some class in teaching English, but they never actually heard the word itself. They're just reading it from on the basis of the way it's written. Then we move on. And then in the middle of the, when we're finished with learning all of the short vowels and the consonant digraph, a consonant digraph is a consonant sound represented by two letters. That's the digraph, two letters. Sh, ch, wh, as in when, where. You know that WH has a slight H sound at the beginning. When did you go? Where did you go? It isn't where and when. Of course, it is where and when. But if you're going to go on the stage, learn to say where and when. Then, of course, we have lots of review. And then we move into, now by lesson 38, we can read all of these, the children can read all of these two-syllable words made up of simple short vowel, three-letter words, like hot dog, box top, zigzag, catnip, ticket, helmet, velvet, tomcat, gallop, lesson, napkin, tidbit, habit, rapid, magic, vivid, nitwit. It's a good time to teach vocabulary. Explain to the child what a nitwit is. Teach vocabulary, even though these words were put down on the basis of their phonetic regularity. Teach vocabulary. I mean, just because they can read the word, they should also know what it means. So if they don't know what vivid sunset, you know, or if they have any problem with any of these words, just have a nice time. Rascal. Well, most kids would know what the word rascal is. That sort of thing. Then we move on. Then we get into the final. We start with the final consonant blends. A consonant blend are two consonants at the end of a word that blend together, as nd, end. The blend is the nd. Ent. Bunk. Nk. You have then act. Aft. Apt. Ask. Ask. It's very important for the youngsters to see the proper sequence, because so many kids today who are taught by sight think that the word ask is axe. You know that they're saying, I asked him a question. Well, but if you know that the S comes before the K, it has to be ask. It's very important. For example, B-E-S-T is best, but B-E-T-S is bets, you see. Bets and best. So it's very important to know which letter comes before the other. But a sight reader just wants to have the same number of letters in the word, if possible. He doesn't care about so much the sequence, because he hasn't been taught that the letters stand for anything except, you know, they're there to look nice, you know. So it's very important to stress that the proper sequence and the proper blending of those final consonants. Then we move into the initial consonant blends, that is the blends at the beginning of the word, such as FR, FRED, FRESH, or PR, PREP, PRIM, or SL, you know, SLOT, SLUMP, all of these wonderful sounds that we have in our wonderful language. Then we always have REVIEW. And finally, we get to the long vowels. Now, if you'll notice, there isn't a single sentence up until that point, up until lesson 72, with a long vowel in it. Isn't it amazing you can do so much with just the short vowels? All of those sentences, not a single long vowel. Now, why do we save the long vowels for last? We save them for last because we have so many different ways of writing the same vowel sound. Let's take, for example, long A. The most common form of long A is A consonant E, as in A-T-E, eight, or pale, P-A-L-E, A-L-E, ale, eight, age, A-G-E. That's A consonant E. That's your first, most, you might say, common form of writing the long A, and we give the child all of the different words from that spelling form, that use that spelling form: abe, babe, face, lace, pace, race, sage, wage, hail, mail, tape, drape, wade, bake, fame, Jane, etc. We give them also the irregular words, or R, which is in the bear, care, dare family, A-R-E, but it's not pronounced air, it's pronounced R. Maybe at one time it was pronounced air, it might have, but it's now pronounced R. And H-A-V-E is not pronounced have, it's pronounced have. But in multisyllabic words, it will be have, as in behave, you see. So it's only irregular when it's used as a word by itself, have. And no child is going to say, I have, you know, a hot dog. I have a hot dog. The next most common way of writing the long A is AI. Two letters together stand for long A, as in aid, A-I-D, mail, M-A-I-L. And one of the reasons why we have these different spellings is so that you can immediately tell which word is. We have so many homonyms in English, homonyms, sorry. That is, words that sound alike but mean different things. For example, male and male. If I just said male, you wouldn't know what male I was talking about. But if I wrote it down, if I wrote M-A-L-E, you would know that I'm talking about a gender. And if I wrote M-A-I-L, you know I'd be talking about the post office. So it helps to have that different spelling so you get immediate recognition when you see the word out of context. We have a couple of words that have to be read in context, like the word read, read and read. The past of read is spelled the same way. I read the book. But there are very few of those words. So this business of context clues is ridiculous because there are so few words that require context to be fully understood. Most of our words will be understood just on the basis of their spelling alone. Well, so we have AI. The next form of long A is AY, as in bay, day, hey, jay, lay, may, clay. Then we have EY, as in gray, they, obey. Then we have EI, EI representing long A, as in rain, vein, veil, air, there, beige. In other words, EI, there isn't an A in sight, and yet the EI together stand for long A. So this business of, you know, that crossing out one letter, as they do sometimes, they'll have M-A-I-L, and they'll cross out the I. No. The two letters together stand for the sound. That's the phonogram. That's what the child sees, and that's what he has to become, he has to associate those two letters with that one sound. Now, that's not so terrible. Other languages are even worse than ours when it comes to that. I know that some of you know French here, so what does EAU stand for in French?
Water.
Oh. EAU stands for O. In other words, EAU, which is the word water in French, O, you know. So don't knock English.
Yes.
No, they don't. But these kids can pick it up. It's not that tricky. It isn't all that difficult. Because once they read the word and associate it with a spoken word, you see, and they see it over and over and over again. The thing about reading is that we learn to read by practice, you see. And the more you see the word, the easier, you know, that it does create an indelible impression on your mind, you see. So you get an immediate response, you see. Well, why don't we say that for the question period? I'll be finished with this pretty soon, and then we can just open up to questions and discussion. With the other form of long A is E-I-G-H. That is the four letters themselves. E-I-G-H stands for the A sound, as in way. Eight. E-I-G-H-T. Eight. So, how many ways do we have to write long A? You've got A, consonant E, A-I, A-Y, E-Y, E-I, E-I-G-H. So, you've got six ways. And that's why we save the long vowels for the M. Then we have all our review words, sentences. Then we take up the OR sound, which is spelled in English A-U or A-W. Two different spellings for the same sound. You just have to know which words are spelled in which way. Then we have the R sound, as in ma and car. We take that up. Then we take up the long E. The most common form of long E is the double E. The second most common form is the EA, as in, you have the meat and meat. You've got three meats, as a matter of fact. To meet out something, you know, to hand it out, meet out, M-E-T-E. Then you have to meet someone at M-E-E-T, and then your steak is meat, M-E-A-T. So three meats, but if they're each spelled differently, and you get instant recognition of the meaning of that word just on the basis of its spelling. We also have the E, consonant E, as in Eve, Steve, these, etc. Now the word I, E-Y-E, which is in that category, so many people try to teach that as a sight word. They say, see the two little eyes and the nose in the middle, E-Y-E? Those are not eyes, and that's not a nose. You know. That is a representation of a spoken word, I. And the reason why we have that spelling is because we have three eyes. We've got first person singular, I, capital I. Then we have A-Y-E, which is, you know, I, sir. And then we have E-Y-E. So it's not a picture. I was talking to somebody the other day who was telling me how he was taught to the word look. His teacher taught him that those two O's were eyes. And to this very day, whenever he sees the word look, he sees two eyes staring at him. It's ridiculous. I said, well, what do you do with words? You know, book, look, shook. I mean, had they taught the child all these different spelling family, he wouldn't be fixated on this one word. But that's what the teachers do these days. Long E is also spelled I-E, as in field, yield, niece, peace, etc. Then you have long E spelled as Y at the ends of words, as daily, city, Kenny, Danny, Y. And we give them plenty of review. Then, of course, you have the same problem with the long I. You have the I consonant E, the I-E, as in lie and pie. You have the Y, I as long I as Y, as in try and dry. And then you have I as I-G-H, high, H-I-G-H. Right, R-I-G-H-T. The I-G-H stands for the one sound, the long I sound. Now, here's a case where probably the pronunciation changed. Because remember, Anglo-Saxon is a pretty guttural language. But it was refined by the French that was put into it. The other influences really softened it. Because Anglo-Saxon was much more like German. Very guttural, very ugly. But with the other influences, our pronunciations, I think, were softened. Here's another a group of words that you just have to learn, the O-U-G-H words, you know, ought, bought, brought, fought, sought, thought, caught. That's C-A-U-G-H-T. So why the difference? Who knows? I mean, you know, we have those anomalies, and you just have to learn them, that's all. That's one of the pleasures of learning our spelling system. Well, anyway, we go through all the rest. We go through the long O, the long U. We take up the OI sound. That's an interesting one, OI. O-I or O-Y. We take up the O-U-L-D, the could, should family, which is, and then the OW sounds, as in house, which is O-U, or power, P-O-W. We take up the double O words, U and U, as in good food. Those are the two sounds of the double O. Good, U, and U, as in food, and etc. And then toward the end, we take up the words like the T-I-O-N, which is pronounced S-H-U-N, the nation, station, fracture, fusion. All of those words come from Latin. They are Latin words that have been anglicized, but the spellings they just tell you where these words came from. That's one of the benefits of our writing, of our spelling system, is that there's a tremendous amount of history in the spellings, and also information about the origins of the words, you see. Now, if all of our words were spelled phonetically, you'd have no idea where they came from. You see, it would be much more difficult to find out where they came from. But the spellings are part of the tradition. Now, remember, this is the English language, and the English people are a very traditional people. You know, they have a queen who rides around in a coach with horses, and she wears a crown, and their judges wear wigs. I mean, so that's what we've inherited, is there's tremendous tradition in our spelling system. You're inheriting a living, vital piece of history. I mean, an alphabet is not something that's made on a computer. Something made by human beings and used by human beings, you see. The last lesson, we take up the Y as short I, as in cyst, gym, mystic, system. Those words come from Latin. If you see a word with a Y representing short I, they come from the Greek. Sorry, they come from the Greek. Well, now, after the child has learned all of this and knows our alphabetic system, then you give him something to read, and you can go to the library. Of course, the Bible is your number one book. But then you could go to the library and pick out anything, and the child's ready to learn to read, ready to now learn English. See, here he has mastered the mechanics of our alphabetic system, of our reading system. Now he has to learn the English language, expand vocabulary, grammar, and all of that. And that's where you go on from there. Now, I always advise parents to start teaching their children to write as soon as they teach them to read words. Up to this point, when they're learning the letters, they can draw the letters, print the letters. But once you start teaching them to read, in other words, letters joined together into words, then you should start teaching them to write cursive. And the reason why I say that is because if you teach cursive first, you can always learn to print later on. But if you teach printing first, many children never make a successful transition to cursive. Many children develop very poor writing habits. And many children, when they get into, the third grade, where they're going to make the switch to cursive, are so busy doing other things that they're not going to slow down to start learning to write each letter perfectly the way they would have to at the very beginning. Now, I was taught cursive first. Everyone in my generation was taught cursive first. And incidentally, I do have the cursive alphabet here in the back of this book, the example of the cursive alphabet, which incidentally I got from the Schaefer Pen Company or the Parker Pen Company, I forget which one. But there it is. But in the How to Tutor book, I have a whole section on writing. Now, they began teaching children printing first, I suppose, back in the late 30s, in the early 40s, when they made that change. But in my generation and previous to my generation, we were all taught cursive first because, first of all, cursive is much more natural for children. If you notice how children like to scrawl on paper, they use the larger motions, muscles, or what do you call that, motor skills. Those wonderful terms, motor skills. Their little motors are running, you know. Anyway, there are only three movements in all of cursive. There's the under curve, the over curve, and the up and down. That's all there is to cursive. So it actually is easier. It's easier for a child to learn cursive than it is for him to do perfect balls and sticks. You know, straight lines and perfect little circles. Another reason why cursive is much better when you're teaching a child to read, first of all, they do not have any problem recognizing the two sets of letters. None whatever. If my generation and your grandparents' generation could do it, your children can do it too. There's no problem. I never heard of a person having it. As a matter of fact, it's easier and it helps, and I'll tell you why. Ball and stick, because so many of the letters are alike, make it easier for the children to confuse the letters. Like, for example, a B and a D. You know what problems some kids have with B's and D's. Or an F and a T. Or a P and a Q. But if you're writing a cursive, you will notice that the B starts out as an L, goes up this way, and goes across. And a D starts as an A, you see. So there's quite a difference. And once that's in their hands, that's once in their motions, they'll never confuse a D with a B, or a B with a D. It's the same with the other one. A P starts like an S. It goes straight up, and then straight down, and then around like that. Whereas a Q starts like an A, you see, and goes around like that and that way. So it helps to distinguish the letters. And then also because the child is also connecting the letters in the word, that also encourages blending. If you have a child who's constantly saying k-at, you know, and you want him to say cat, well, if he's spelling C-A-T and it's all joined together, it's easier to get him to, he'll make the transition faster to the blend, much more easier. And also when you're writing the consonant blends, that also helps too. So that's why I strongly urge you to teach cursive, because printing is a waste of time. As you know, some children never develop a good cursive. Some children will just print for the rest of their lives. Some children will develop a hybrid, a part cursive, part print. And then some will develop a cursive, but most people make a royal mess. These days, you've seen some of these bank tellers, the way they hold their pens, you would think they were cripples. I mean, you know, four fingers, five fingers, I mean, as many as I can, you know, the fist. It really is ridiculous. Teach your child to hold the pen correctly. It's the easiest, simplest way, the three fingers. You know, and once, if you permit your child to develop using four fingers, forget it. You'll never break that habit. It's almost impossible to get them to break a habit. That's why when you're starting out, make sure that they develop good habits to begin with. Don't expect them to change later on. Do not tolerate a sloppy way of holding the pen, because once that becomes fixed, it'll be like pulling teeth to get them to change. So if you don't permit them to develop a bad habit, they won't. But our public schools encourage bad habits. For example, they have invented spelling now, which they tell the kids, spell it any way you want. And they say, well, the kids later on will find out the real way, the correct way to spell it. But how many kids actually do? And don't you think it's rather embarrassing to find out that you've been spelling a word wrong for 2 years? You know, and then children want to do it right the first time. I remember once I was sitting on a plane, and there was a little girl sitting next to me, and she was reading, and I asked her if she knew her cursive. She didn't, so I started teaching her cursive. Well, she wanted to know how to do it correctly, you know, and she followed instructions very beautifully. But who knows, maybe when she went to public school they undid it. But But at least, you know, they want to do it correctly the first time, because children always want to be right. They don't want to be embarrassed. Humiliation is the worst thing that children bear. You know how they feel ashamed. So if you teach them to do it right the first time, they'll thank you for it. Well, I'll now open it up for questions. We have a good 15 minutes. Yes, you had a
question.
Yeah, some air. I think it's we've got steam heat in here. Unless you can open one of those windows. Yeah. Now, you wanted about the age. I've had a mother in Portland, Oregon, at a homeschool conference came up to me, and she had a 3.5-year-old who was learning to read alpha phonics, and she turned to the last lesson she had had, and it was one of the lessons with sentences, and the little girl just read them slowly but perfectly. Did an excellent job, and by the time she was 4, she had completed the book. Now, granted, that was a very intelligent little girl, very articulate, but I would say that if a youngster has developed his speech to a point where it's pretty good speaking vocabulary, and expresses a desire to learn to read, start.
They need to know their letters then first, or they would...
Teach them the letters, teach them the alphabet, and then go into the letter sounds. And always be patient. Never scold. That to my mind is the most important thing. Patience, patience, patience. Some parents get awfully upset if the child doesn't catch on immediately. But, you know.
You kind of hit little blocks. I started with my daughter because her vocabulary and her speech was real good. But she seemed to not really be that interested. And so I stopped because I didn't want it to be a negative kind of thing.
Yeah, if she's not interested. But, of course, if she gets to the age of 10 and is still not interested, I'd say, you know, honey, it's now time for you to learn to read, because you're going to have to fill out an income tax return pretty soon. Yes?
The child has been taught sightseeing and is having trouble. Can it be reversed?
Yeah, that's one of the big problems today. As a matter of fact, my latest newsletter, which I had copies of which I've got at my table, discusses a recent research finding by a gentleman in North Carolina who found out that children can become dyslexic in preschool if they have memorized, say, the Dr. Seuss books, and if they have memorized the words by sight and have developed an ability to repeat these words at a rate of 30 words per minute or more. Then they developed an automatic way of looking at words as wholes, holistically, and that creates a block against looking at words phonetically. And he's devised a wonderful test where he's taken the words from Green Eggs and Ham and The Cat in the Hat, and he has the children read through that list of words, and usually they just tear through them, they do beautifully. Then he has a similar list of words taken from Dr. Flesch's word list in the back of Why Johnny Can't Read, which are very simple, one syllable, perfectly regular phonetic words, and these kids have terrible time just reading those simple words, which means that they are educationally dyslexic, because they can't look at these words phonetically. They're trying to look at a picture of some kind, and the picture's not coming up on the screen. So the only way that you can cure that, the only way that you can cure dyslexia, and only sight readers are dyslexic, a phonetic reader cannot become dyslexic, is to change a sight reader into a phonetic reader. Now, how do you do that? Well, the first thing you have to do is teach the child our alphabetic system. Now, I've taught a lot of the older youngsters who have problems, and what I do is first I take them through this entire book. And then I have them apply this, their new phonetic knowledge, to their reading, because they don't automatically become phonetic readers simply because they've learned the phonetic system, because they have this automatic way of looking at words. So what you have to do then, what I would do with the older youngsters, is have them read the Reader's Digest, because we could read one article per session. And then every time they'd come to for example, if they skipped a word, or put in a word that isn't there, I'd have them reread the sentence until they realize that they'd put in a word that wasn't there. Or if they left out a word that was there, I would have them stop and reread it until they realized that they had left out a word that was there. Then when we came across multisyllabic words, I would have them write the word, break it up into syllables, and learn to pronounce it. And so they would have a notebook you know, after a couple of months, you know, a couple of thousand words, which then we would go over so that they would become more familiar with them and know how to break them up into syllables. And it's in developing the ability to read multisyllabic words where they will become phonetic. I don't know if you can undo their initial sight habits with that group of sight words that they've learned. You know, maybe they've learned 500 sight words or 300 sight words, but when it comes to multisyllabic words, they will have to become phonetic readers if they're ever going to be able to master them. And I taught one young man who was in college. He had never read a book in his life for pleasure. He only read what he had to in school. And it took about two and a half years to get him to the point where now he is never without a book. He loves to read. And I gave him high interest books to read. He wanted to become wealthy in real estate. So we read a lot of books on how to become, you know, rich in 50 lessons, or, you know, how to become a millionaire in real estate. He was, you know, that sort of thing. That helps too, to get books of high interest to the particular youngster, but it can be done. But it requires intensive intervention. And you've got to have incredible patience with these youngsters as they try to make the transition. Then you might use flashcards so that they get, so that they can look at the letters and say the sounds, that sort of thing. Yes?
Children start to crayon. My 3.5-year-old, he really doesn't like to crayon very much. He'd rather build blocks.
Yeah.
And if I try to get him to crayon, he'll hold his crayon any old way. And is that the time to start making, to make sure they're...
Well, how old is he?
3.5.
Well, 3.5, they're going to hold crayons, so you might try, but at that age, I don't think it's going to, it's only going to matter when, you know, the beautiful thing about learning cursive when I was going to school in the first grade, first of all, we were all 6 years old, and also we had, you know, pencils and also ink, wet ink, yeah. So you had to be very careful, you see, when you're learning letters. I think when you get to the point where you're teaching him to write letters, I mean, if he's just using the crayon just to, you know, make fill in spaces, I wouldn't worry so much about that.
And teaching him the alphabet now, we're just doing it thoroughly and trying to get him to recognize the letters. Is that the wrong way to do it?
No, there's nothing wrong. Yeah, he's got to recognize the letters. That's good.
But then you mentioned that they should start to write at the same time.
No, when you teach reading, okay. Not when you teach the letters. Teaching the letters of the alphabet, they can draw the letters of the alphabet. But when you start teaching them to read, that is the letters together, making words, then, and they're going to start writing because you're going to want them to copy the words. You see. Now, how are you going to have them copy the words? Print them out, or shall they start writing cursive? Because that's part of learning to read and to spell, is to write the words that they're learning. So you want them to do cursive.
So when they copy the letters, do they copy printed letters that they see? Or?
They can copy printed letters any way they want. Ball and stick is a horrible invention. That means nothing. It just satisfied some ignoramus educators. There's no rhyme or reason for ball and stick. They thought that was a simple, just balls and sticks, circles and sticks, and that's easy. That's not easy. It's confusing, it's dull, it's ridiculous. Yes, yes, ma'am.
I was listening to what you said about if your child is, you know, wanting to learn to read, to start from young, how do you manage it and to do the right at the same time?
Yeah, yeah, that's what you would do. You would postpone the writing aspect and teach them as much of the reading as they like, you know. Yeah, when they start learning to write, you teach them cursive. So all I'm saying, at whatever point you decide to teach the child to write, teach them cursive writing. Because let's face it, children will develop only one writing style for the rest of their lives. How many of you use more than one writing style? All right, there's one. But I mean for everyday writing. Well, because you wrote, you were taught printing. That's why you develop more than one style. But you don't have the time, or most people do not have the time or inclination to develop more than one standard way of writing. So you have time at the beginning to teach them to make each letter well, you know, make good representations of the letters. And when you start teaching them to write, teach them cursive. That's all I'm saying. Whenever you start, teach them cursive, whatever that point that might be. Then I don't know. I would say that when their motor skills are at that point, they seem to be 5, 6, around that time. I would say there's a good deal of variation on that. Yes? Yeah. Yeah. There you are, kindergarten. Yes, ma'am.
Is your book designed to be one lesson a day?
No, you can have as many lessons as you want to go through. Now, the lessons simply say that something new is being taught.
So you might want to actually stretch it in 3 days.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, usually, for example, they will learn the first 3 lessons at the very beginning because it's so easy. But then the drills, you may want to take a day or two. You see, like drills like this, you want to take more than just one day.
Can you stretch that into spelling lessons and spelling drill?
Whatever you feel that they have to know. I mean, that's up to you. That's up to you. You can use your judgment on that, you know. But have them write for homework. In other words, what they do when they're not learning to read, practice their writing. In other words, they should have a reading component and a writing component. In any case, I will have these books on sale, and my newsletter, the March newsletter, you may want to get that also. Thank you very much.